This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. This is the In the Garden program, show produced by UC Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners of Orange County. I'm Chris Bonner, your Master Gardener host for the hour. Today's program is Dried Out Yards Are Not a Virtue, and it features an interview with UC Extension Environmental Horticulturalist Don Hodel. Good morning, Don. It's so nice to have you on the show today.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be back.
Don's an environmental horticulturalist with UC Cooperative Extension in Los Angeles, where he's worked for over 30 years. He was with us a couple of months ago to do the show on palm trees that I think some of you heard. Don specializes in the selection and management of trees and landscape plants, including irrigation. He's got 8 books, 86 peer-reviewed articles, and over 430 trade and popular articles. Wow. So today's topic is landscape irrigation in times of drought. While it's not as common as last fall, we see stories in the media about drought-related topics on a regular basis. Changing climate and weather patterns suggest that we really should think about how to plan and sustain our water use for to maintain agriculture, our cities, and our home landscapes in times of fluctuating and possibly uncertain water supplies. Last fall, I was just getting ready to start the Master Gardener training program, and I opened up my LA Times, and as an avid gardener, I saw a commentary that really caught my attention. California drought. Dried out yards are not a virtue. Urban landscape irrigation accounts for only a small part, less than 9% of the water used in the state. And then the piece starts with, such a recommendation might seem irresponsible in the face of California drought, but the recent rush to slash urban landscape water use and in the process let trees, shrubs, and lawns decline or die is short-sighted, foolish, expensive, and most of all, unnecessary. So I just want to kind of start out with kind of a big picture. Don, what made it motivated you and your co-author, Dennis Pettinger, to write this commentary last fall?
Well, for me, the straw that broke the camel's back was when Governor Brown came out with his edicts, I think it was in March or April of 2015, mandating slashing landscape irrigation in certain areas of the landscape 25 to 30%. And I thought this was sort of a knee-jerk reaction, and I didn't think it was necessary. And I could already see trees and landscapes suffering and declining. So I couldn't take it anymore, and I had to say something about it. So I wrote a draft, showed it to my colleague Dennis Pittenger. And he joined me, and we finished it and submitted it to the LA Times. It's actually based on an article that we published in the online e-journal Palm Arbor, which is at a UC website.
Right. Great. So that kind of got you started on this thing. So you start your the piece starts out talking about the benefits. Most people, especially gardeners listening, know that gardens are good intrinsically. And they get enjoyment out of tending and spending time in the yards. But even gardeners may not know or think about all the positive values that landscapes bring us in our communities. Could you walk us through, kind of setting the stage or kind of a foundation, what the benefits are of having trees, shrubs, and dare I say lawns in our yards?
As you implied, Chris, many people take for granted the amenities and benefits that landscapes provide in urban living. And in the article, I listed several, and these include shade and energy savings, especially as they relate to heating and cooling, privacy, food. Many of us are avid home food producers.
Right. Vegetables, fruits.
Vegetables, fruits, sure. Wildlife habitat. In urban areas, natural habitat for natural animals is becoming scarcer and scarcer, and so we can provide wildlife habitat.
And part of the richness of life, I think, is being able to see, birds and other wildlife in our yards enjoying the space with us. I mean, it's always a cool thing when you're seeing an interesting bird or You know, sometimes maybe a raptor or a hawk might come in. I mean, it's just kind of a magical moment when you see that.
Absolutely. Oxygen. Granted, most of the oxygen that we breathe probably comes from the ocean, from algae and other plants, ocean plants. But trees and shrubs and ground covers on the land also provide oxygen for us. Jobs, many people overlook this. The landscape industry is a significant creator of jobs in the Southern California economy.
So you've got growers, you've got nurseries, you've got people that do landscape installations, you have companies that do landscape maintenance.
That's true, and it employs tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, and has hundreds of millions of dollars in economic impact.
So it's actually a positive benefit to our local economy.
Absolutely. Carbon sequestration, which, you know, as the whole process of photosynthesis, where plants take in carbon dioxide and use water and produce oxygen and carbohydrates, this is a process that will help us to mitigate the impacts of global warming by taking carbon out of the atmosphere.
And California is one of the leaders in really trying to set an example for the rest of the country and, dare I say, the rest of the world to have a more carbon neutral, more carbon responsible footprint on the environment so that our kids' kids will have a healthy, pleasantly temperate world to come into. And so plants certainly is one of the easiest and most cost-effective ways. There are lots of exotic ways they're looking at for carbon sequestration, but having, you know, a vibrant landscape with lots of plants that holds this carbon over long periods of time, this is a good thing.
I think it's very good, and it gives everybody the opportunity to participate and have a stake in reducing global warming. Plants capture and retain rainwater and help to control erosion. It's obvious that they enhance property values, and this has actually been quantified. Landscapes provide recreational opportunities.
Right.
Imagine if we had to get rid of all the turf grass in a park or a school playground. Would you want your kids running and playing on asphalt or bare dirt? No, we wouldn't. Many trees have cultural and historic value. You can often trace the history and development of Southern California through individual tree specimens.
Oh, interesting.
Or collections of such trees. Yeah, in 1984, I wrote a book called Exceptional Trees of Los Angeles, which identified and located and documented many of these historic trees. And even the psychological well-being.
So psychological well-being, so in terms of wellness. So let's talk about well-being and wellness. You wrote in the commentary that there was a study that talks about the value of trees specifically to wellness, and that they bring us, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there was a Canadian study done, I think, in 2015 that quantified some of these benefits and amenities that landscapes provide. And what they found was that having 10 additional trees on a city block improved the health perception of the residents in ways comparable to an increase in annual personal income of $10,000 or moving to a neighborhood with a $10,000 higher median income.
So we talk about how money doesn't buy happiness, but everyone knows kind of the inverse of lack of money, and stress and worry about money doesn't make you feel good. And so this idea that your surrounding landscapes actually creates the good feeling that would come with actually making more money without having to make more money.
That's a good way of looking at it.
That is wild. I never would have thought that. I mean, I think about property values themselves, and I used to be involved in a homeowners association, and we actually looked at trying to figure out, well, what are the trees worth, and is it worth us to maintain and support trees? And now you can actually find that, you know, a mature tree is worth, you know, anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000.
Or more.
Or more.
A lot more.
And if it's for a home, it can be for a lot more, because everyone knows that curb appeal when you drive up to a house really does make a difference. And so if you think about investment in your landscaping and the effort, as home gardeners listening know, to make that attractive and aesthetic and healthy, that's actually literally money in the bank and improving the value of your home. So let's talk about landscape water use and how much water home landscapes actually use. Statewide, the drought has eased somewhat statewide, but here in Southern California, we had another below average rainfall year. We all want to do our part to wisely use the precious water that we have, but big picture now, how much water are we really talking about that's used in home landscapes?
Well, the State Department of Water Resources, which is the main state agency that overviews water, says that 9% of all the developed water in California ends up on the home landscape.
9%.
Nine. So this means...
Not 90.
So this means if we never watered another tree, another shrub, another ground cover, another herbaceous plant, another piece of one blade of grass in California again that's in the landscape, California would save a whopping 9% of all the water used in the state.
Now, I know that, you know, kind of a common number that's kicked around a lot is that outdoor uses of water in urban areas makes up 50% of the urban use. So that means, I guess, that only 18% of the state water is going for urban uses, and the rest is going where?
Yes, about 20% of the water used in California ends up in the urban area. The other 80% is used for agriculture.
Really? 80%?
75 to 80%, yes.
So when we see those billboards that talk about, you know, farmers not having the water, they're getting 8 out of every 10 gallons that's available in the state. They're the ones using that.
That's true, but farmers grow the food that we need.
And again, I'm not trying to knock farmers. I came from an ag school, UC Davis. I love farms. I love to eat, as you do. And so I like food, and I like and I do like the economic benefit that agriculture has to the state, too. But I think your point is, you know, it's trying to balance the federal budget on the 10% discretionary part of the budget. Even if you eliminate it, you still get a budget deficit problem. So you have to look at, where are we spending the money? Where are we spending the water to really make a difference? We can't just do it on the backs of homeowners, I think, is what you were saying here.
Yeah, yes. And I would also like to add that agriculture in California for many years has been a worldwide leader in the accurate use and application of water to agricultural crops. So I actually don't think there's a lot of wasted water in agriculture. Yes, there are a few celebrated instances where people can point and say, well, look at you using all this water to grow rice or to grow almonds or what have you. But generally, agriculture has been a leader in efficient water use, a worldwide leader.
Well, that's really a good point. And so kind of in this whole conversation, and unfortunately, we seem to live in a time where people want to assess blame. And so we want to blame lawns, we want to blame farmers, we want to blame cities, depending on where you live and what your perspective is. And so I like this point that we really shouldn't be trying to look for the bad guys in this. We should be trying to work together to wisely use the water resources that we have.
That's correct. And I also like to revisit that 9% figure.
Okay.
And for many years, the state was saying it was 4%.
Oh, really?
4%, yes. And then when we got into this drought, the figure...
Magically, the number doubled?
More than doubled to 9%.
How'd they come up with that?
I don't know.
That's interesting.
It is interesting.
Because if it's 4%, then it's like, well, what are you talking about?
Exactly. So I think they're getting a little bit more purchase power by upping the amount, but it's hard to say. But anyway, it's a small amount of water ends up on the urban landscape relative to statewide use. And your point is very good in that how can we, by reducing that small amount by a percentage of 25 or 30%, it's not going to free up a lot of water in the state.
No, it's not. So there are expenses and costs related to not properly irrigating landscapes. So we've talked about what the benefits are. Let's talk about some of the costs and expenses. So tell us about some of those.
Well, if we don't irrigate our landscapes, or if we under-irrigate them,
okay,
the landscapes are going to decline. And so we'll be losing those amenities and benefits. That's one cost. Another cost is dried out landscapes are more of a fire hazard, and we're reminded of that recently by the spate of wildfires we've had.
Absolutely, and fire season seems to become our year-round thing.
Yes, and also, and this is frequently overlooked, when trees die, they become hazardous.
Ah.
So they have to be pruned or removed, and that's expensive. And if a tree falls or a branch falls and causes property damage or hurts people, there's potential lawsuits that are going to occur. And, these costs mount up, and many times they are not elucidated clearly by the people who tell you, oh, don't water those landscapes, they'll be fine.
You know, 10 years ago when I redid my yard, I had to have two large pine trees taken out. And these were aggressive, fast-growing pine trees that the original homeowner had planted in a place that wasn't a good spot. I mean, it was a great tree, but it was not a good location for that tree. And so I had to take these two trees out, and I was a little shocked in terms of what the cost of removing a tree is. And they don't care if the tree is dead or alive. It's probably cheaper to do a live tree because they can chip it easier and it's safer for them to go up and tree to work. But I got quotes of anywhere from $500 to $800 a tree to $1,000 a tree to take a tree out. And it's like, oh. So if we're talking about reducing trees and limiting trees and losing that shade, losing the aesthetic benefits, but just dollars and cents, the cost of taking out dead trees, it's like, I don't want to be in that situation again.
Yes, the direct cost to remove trees is significant. And another cost that people don't consider is that if we change landscapes, change them out, we often have to install new types of irrigation. And this will be expensive also, retrofitting irrigation systems to be appropriate for the new landscape.
Now, when you're opening tees, you say that, you know, recommendation for, you know, watering your yard, you know, you probably should be doing it. You say that it's short-sighted, foolish, expensive, and most of all, unnecessary, tragically unnecessary. So let's talk about that. Do we really need to re-landscape our yards to become more water-wise?
No, we don't, Chris. And this is one of the tragedies of the knee-jerk 25 or 30% mandated reduction in landscape water use that the state came up with. And many of our plants, most of our plants that we already have in our landscape, are already low water use plants.
Oh, really?
It's just that we don't water them in an appropriate manner.
Ah, okay.
And many, many years, I would say 30 years of University of California research has shown that we can retain most of our landscapes without much change in them, still get the benefits from them, and still reduce significant amounts of water, maybe up to 25 or 30%, without having to get rid of the landscapes or make expensive changeovers to what are traditionally called low water use or drought tolerant plants. Most of our plants are already that way, but in most cases we're not watering them as if they were.
So when I started the Master Gardener classes and I got the hydrology, when I got to the hydrology lesson, right, and we talked about what a yard need, what a plants need, it was pretty clear. And I got some nasty notes from my water district, too, that I was using more water than I needed to use. And after I I'm a science-based kind of a guy, so I actually went and looked, and it's like kind of the one thing that stuck out from somebody's someplace on UC websites was most, this was a year ago, most it's common for home gardeners to overwater by 50%, that you could easily cut back your watering by 50% and still have a fine yard. And, you know, water was never that expensive, and it was just easier for me to, you know, didn't break the bank, and I didn't care about it back before we had all the concern about drought. It wasn't a big deal for me to overwater. I thought, well, all right, let's try this out. So I actually totaled up all my my circuit minutes, you know, and how many days per week and how many minutes of watering, and even without getting into the calculations of how many gallons and how many heads, just dealing with irrigation minutes, I changed my lawn to 3 days a week. So I went from 7 days a week down to 3 days a week. And I changed it to make it earlier watering, earlier irrigation, and I extended how long the irrigation cycles were on those 3 days. But now I was, you know, watering Monday, Wednesday, Friday, not watering Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday. And I would turn the sprinklers off one of the weekend days anyhow to mow the lawn, so that was really no change. So that was really not that much of a difference on my part, and I drastically, my water usage drastically went down. And I did notice I had a few problems in my lawn, some brown spots, but those are really more related to malfunctioning equipment and sprinkler heads. So I had to do some adjustments there. There was one spot that really, the original layout wasn't a good layout. And so I hand watered that spot for a while, and then I finally just kind of got okay with the idea that maybe I don't have a perfect lawn. I used to pride myself, and I think I got this from my father-in-law, of having a pristine monoculture perfect lawn that was lush and green, and I've always done a self-mulching mower, so I've never had green waste. But I changed the height that I mowed things at, lowering the water, the other thing I did is I reduced how much fertilizer I was putting on. I used to have this wonderful emerald green lawn. It's still green, but it's not as richly green as it used to be. But when I fertilize less, it grows less, and so now I mow less. And actually, you know, some weeks I can skip mowing. I don't necessarily have to mow my lawn every week, and it can still look pretty good. Now, before company comes, I'll give it a trim because I want it to look nice and pristine. But so this idea of just cutting, not changing the lawn out, but just changing the watering, changing the fertilizing, changing the cultural practices of lawn height, I'm using a lot less water than I was 2 years ago.
And you still have a decent-looking landscape.
And I have a beautiful-looking landscape.
Okay. Yours is the perfect example of what we can do. It seems like, to me, the leadership from the state when they came out with these mandates was just, okay, you got to cut 25 or 30%, and that was it. But there was no leadership, there was no guidance to help people do that. And we've been trying at the University of California to educate people on how to irrigate their landscapes for many, many years, and many people have adapted our information, but unfortunately many haven't. But for example, just changing from a cool season turf grass to a warm season turf grass can save about 20 to 25% water right there.
So you can still have a lawn, just change the species out.
Exactly, exactly.
So water providers have created lots of rules about what we can and can't do. I know some of my friends, they live in communities where they're only allowed to use their sprinkler system one day a week. And so what this has meant is a lot of people are out there, either stuff's dying or they're having to hand water. There's no restrictions on hand watering, so they do a lot of hand watering. But you write that it sounds like the rules that have come out, you describe them as being horticulturally unsound. So what are some examples of watering rules that are likely to have negative effects on landscape planting?
Well, you mentioned one right there, this idea, these restrictions that were placed on when you could water and for how long you could water are horticulturally unsound because they don't take into account how fast water is applied to the soil, how the soil takes up water and holds water,
right,
and how the plant takes water out of the soil to grow. And in many cases, having the sprinkler run for just 5 minutes, 2 days a week, isn't going to put on sufficient amount of water to maintain those plants in a healthy condition.
What happens to root growth if you, over a period of time, you consistently go for short durations versus longer irrigation cycle times?
Well, what happens when you water lightly but frequently, as you're stating, is you have a root system that's very close to the surface of the soil.
Okay.
I mean, generally, plant roots are close to the surface, but light, frequent waterings exacerbate that, and you have all the roots trying to extract moisture from a very
just a few inches
near the surface. And there's very little deeper rooting, and when we do have times of drought or extremely hot weather, those roots don't have much water to pull on. Their reservoir or zone where they can access water is very limited there.
So they're going to hit the permanent wilting point. They're going to get into heat stress. They're going to start to have die-off damage.
Exactly.
Because the roots are we're encouraging lawns
yes.
to have shallower roots.
Yes.
So this is a case where... I don't know that there's a good answer here. You've got rules from your water district, but it's not based on how to have a lawn. You could actually water less frequently, deeper, perhaps.
Yes, that would be instead of watering twice a week or three times a week, 10 minutes each time. It'd be better to water twice a week, 15 minutes each time.
Ah, okay.
Generally.
I know another favorite topic, a bone to pick for you in this whole thing, is what's been going on with cities and the landscape medians in our streets. And again, this brings – it's high visibility. People are seeing this. And tell us about what's going on with some of the public space landscaping.
Well, one of the most prominent parts of the mandated water restrictions that came out in 2015 – was this outright ban on watering medians in streets. And unfortunately, or fortunately for us, many of those medians have trees in them.
Right.
And so the municipalities or whichever governing body controlled those medians, because there was turf grass there or lawn, they quit watering them. And so the trees started to suffer and die. Now, a few municipalities saw the folly of this, and they started retrofitting their irrigation systems by putting drip irrigation around the trees out to the drip line of the tree. And,
right.
and this was good. It's not good enough, but it was still better than
before. They were
before.
Doing something.
And the trees were being saved. Otherwise, they would have died completely. But it's like a little bit... too little, too late, because this behavior pattern of not irrigating medians had already been set and entrenched. But fortunately, with time, many cities are seeing that was unwise, and they're starting to water their trees again. And I think even the state has backed off on that. The state has said, well, if there are trees there, you can water.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because, again, it's, you know, I can, if you have just turf and trees in a median, that's not that interesting of a landscape. And, you know, my city where I live, they've actually been replacing the medians. And what they did is they left the trees. They left the larger specimen trees that they've got. And they've come in around. They did take the turf out because, again, you got worker safety issues. You got water use issues. So, again, I got no bone to pick with taking turf out of a median. I think that could make sense. And they're coming in with some interesting rocks and succulents and some smaller, lower growing shrubs that, again, I'm not sure what the species are, but they just look like there's less plant material. And if this is a smaller plant, it's probably using somewhat less water. So, but again, there's a cost, right? Because now these contractors to pull out the old stuff and put in the new stuff, and they're laying in, they have to do a new irrigation system. So what we talked about previously, the expenses to the homeowners, This is true for our cities and counties, too, to redo the public landscaping.
Yes, yes. And that retrofitting and re-landscaping of those medians is a perfect example of what I talked about earlier, about one of the indirect or hidden costs of this whole reduced landscape water use.
So I'd like to take a short break right now to let you know that you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and also on KUCI.org online. This is the In the Garden program produced by the UC Master Gardeners of Orange County, and I'm Chris Bonner, your host. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. If you want to get more information about this topic or any other topic, just go online and do a internet search on OC Master Gardeners, and you'll get the link to the UC Master Gardener program here in Orange County. There's lots of great information about weeds and pests, ornamental plants, edibles, lots of photos to do identification to help you be a more successful gardener. This week's topic is dried-out yards are not a virtue. My guest is Don Hodel, an environmental horticulturalist with the University of California Cooperative Extension in Los Angeles. Now let's return to our interview with Don. So one of the, I think, public enemy number one in this whole drought is lawns. It just seems like somehow, you know, brown is the new green. You know, it's become socially irresponsible to have a lawn. You know, people are shaming neighbors and reporting neighbors. And it's somehow, without getting into any, you know, science-based information, it kind of seems like, you know, socially, it's like you can't have a healthy, good-looking lawn, that somehow that's a bad or a wrong thing. So let's talk about water use in lawns.
Well, water use in lawns accounts for 3 to 5% of all the water used in California.
3 to 5%. So if we got rid of every square foot of lawn in the state, it would barely move the needle.
That's correct. And that's based on the figure of landscapes accounting for 9%,
which may be inflated.
Which may be inflated, maybe doubled, and which would lower the actual lawn water use to about 1.5% to 2.5% of the total amount of water used in California.
Now, my lawns are tall fescue, and that's a great product. I like it. I like the barefoot appeal to it. I like the visual of it. You talked about switching out from these cool season grasses that are more water intensive, and especially in the hot time of year. What are some examples of some other lawn species that home gardeners could think about switching to?
Well, actually, if you want a cool season grass,
yeah,
these new tall fescue types,
yes,
are actually low water use for cool season grasses. So don't feel too bad about maintaining that,
okay.
Chris.
Thanks for lifting some of my guilt.
Yeah, okay. But some of the warm season grasses that would use less water would be Zoysia, Bermuda,
uh-huh,
and things like this that require 20 to 25% less than the typical cool season.
We're going to come back to lawn removal and replacement in a minute, so won't get into more specifics at that time on that topic. So let's a favorite topic of mine, and again, is artificial turf. And I have to say that initially I was kind of gaga. Some of the artificial turf, it looked really cool. It was different. It was kind of fun and exciting. Initially I kind of liked the look of it, but then I started to see some not so good installation of artificial turf, and it looked like somebody rolled a piece of carpet out on the front yard, and turf rebates certainly spurred a lot on homeowners both to take out lawns and replace them with artificial turf. So share with our listeners a little bit more about artificial turf.
Well, artificial turf is a synthetic material. It's petroleum-based. And the research has shown that it doesn't provide the same types of benefits that natural turf does.
Okay.
In other words, I don't think it doesn't have the cooling benefit.
Right.
And yes, you don't have to water it, but it doesn't provide the cooling benefit. It requires a lot of petroleum to make it, energy to make it.
Right.
And of course, it's not going to break down in the landscape. It's like putting a synthetic, almost like a plastic material in the landscape.
So when it gets, anything that man makes at some point doesn't last. So you're going to have to, it's going to look ratty and not right at some point.
Then,
so what do you do with it? Where does it end up?
It ends up in a landfill.
Oh, that's not so good, is it?
No. So, producing turf grass isn't zero energy either.
No.
But at least turf grass, you can, the clippings that you get from it, you can reuse as mulch. You don't have to send it to the landfill.
Right.
In fact, we encourage people not to send them to the landfill, but to use them as a natural mulch within your own yard or garden.
And that's what I do right now. I use an electric lawnmower, and I've used one for years. And one, I never have to worry about running out of gas, but I like the fact that it's not adding to air pollution. And again, there still is a cost, usually a petroleum-based product out there someplace that's powering a power plant at least part of the time. So it's not like it doesn't have any impact on the carbon load, but it certainly is a lot less than people with gas-fired lawnmowers. So greenhouse gases. What about water runoff in these artificial turf lawns? What how does that work?
That's a good question. I think some of the first ones that came out, they were just like impermeable sheets, and the water would just sheet off them to the side, which could create erosion or flooding problems. I think now some of the newer ones are more permeable to water, so they're probably a little bit better for that.
Okay, so maybe they've improved the product, so maybe that's not as much of an issue as it was with the early ones. Next, I want to talk about meeting future water needs by reducing landscape irrigation. So let's take a step back and look at this from a statewide policy perspective. Can't we just re-landscape California to have enough water to live happily ever after without the nagging, threatening letters from our water providers?
Well, that's a good question, Chris. But the growth projections show that every 10 years in California, 4 million new people are added.
4 million people. How many people live in the city of Los Angeles?
About 4 million. So that's like adding another Los Angeles every 10 years to California.
Now, it's not one place. It's spread all over the place.
Sure, sure.
But still, a new Los Angeles every 10 years.
Sure.
And that has water requirements, yes?
Sure.
Now, under CEQA, there are requirements to identify water sources, but it's kind of a shell game going on here in terms of showing where the water comes from to justify the development. So I guess your point here is that from a policy perspective, we don't seem to have any problem with development. And again, we all like development at some level, I think. But this idea of trying to put it, again, on the back of home landscapes to make more water available to build more cities that have more water requirements, it's where does this lead, right?
Well, I think many home gardeners find it particularly galling that as they try very conscientiously to reduce their water use, they can look down the street or in the next city and see 100, 200, or 1,000 new homes being built. And again, I'm not anti-growth, and I don't believe water should be wasted. It's a precious commodity.
Right, right.
But at the same time, I don't see, and it appears to me, that the state is trying to put on the backs of that 9% all the savings to accommodate this new growth. It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't add up. And I think this is an issue that wasn't clearly stated, how the state's going to accommodate that.
So let's, before we kind of move into the practical part of this program, so let's just end up with, can we have our beautiful landscapes and still save water?
Absolutely. There's no reason why we can't have nice landscapes and still save water. In fact, one of the things that discouraged me the most was that it seemed that many people took these mandated water cutbacks as a signal to them that they didn't have to water at all.
Right,
And I thought I think that's unfortunate. And I think, again, that goes back to a lack of leadership when these mandates came out. For example, if you watered your yard 4 days a week, All you have to do is change it to 3 days a week, and you've saved 25% right there.
Right.
Doesn't mean you have to quit watering your yard completely.
Right.
It just means reduce it. And you probably still have, as you found out personally with your yard, that you still have at least a decent, if not still more than adequate looking yard.
Right, right. I think that's true. And I think it's surprising, and you know, I guess I would challenge our listeners out there, if they haven't already, and most of them probably have done this with the prodding from their water providers, but if you haven't done this yet, carefully, responsibly testing how much water you're using and monitoring the situation to really find out what your water needs are, because for most of us, we don't really know, and we just, you know, we know it when we don't do enough water, because then the plants start to stress and to die. And in vegetables, it's really easy to know if you're not giving them enough water. But, you know, if I've got a sick-looking plant, is that because of under-irrigation, or is that because I might have a pest problem? I mean, it's complicated to kind of to figure out what some of the garden problems are and watering. But I guess I want to challenge the gardeners out there to try to change some things up and spend some time in the garden and really try to figure out what your water needs are so that you're getting the most out of it, the biggest bang for the buck for the water you are using.
Yes, there's actually a science behind watering plants. And it's pretty simple. It takes some experience to become confident and comfortable with
right.
it. But I always say judicious irrigation. You're putting on the amount of water the plant needs, no more, no less. And it can be done, and it's not too hard to learn how to do it.
One of the basic things that we learned in our Master Gardener class is to find out how much water is really going onto your landscape. And again, there are some fancy devices you can use to capture water. It's got gradations to monitor it, or you could use tuna cans or something much more prosaic and easily and cheaper available. But this idea of putting out some sort of a container and turning your sprinklers on to see how much water is really being distributed. Tell us about that. Is that something that the average homeowner can do?
I think so, especially in a lawn area where it's open and there aren't any obstructions. It just set out a grid of tuna fish cans or cat food cans, run your system for 15 minutes or so, and then measure the amount of water that's collected in these cans, and that'll give you a pretty good idea of how much water is going on.
So I think people get confused. You know, is it gallons of water going on? Is it inches of water going on? What's the kind of the metric that they should be thinking about?
Well, in most cases, it's inches of water that okay. we want to deal in.
Right, right.
And if you know that your system's putting on a half inch of water in 15 minutes, then you can adjust your irrigation run times accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, on a heavier clay soil
that a lot of us have
that holds a lot more water.
Right.
You should be watering more to put more water on.
Okay.
And then you can water less frequently because it holds more water.
Right.
On a sandy light soil, you have to put less water on,
right?
But you have to water more frequently.
Because it's going to percolate through.
And it'll be lost to evaporation.
So let's talk a little about some practical aspects of garden rejuvenation and landscaping. And it might be motivated by reducing your water usage. It might just be time to do something in your yard. It might be a complete redo or it might be a partial redo. But help some of our listeners, you know, if they're thinking about redoing some or all of their landscaping, what are some things to keep in mind besides water use that they should be thinking about in terms of how they approach maybe philosophically or generally how they should be considering redoing their yard? What are some of these benefits, coming back to those benefits and aspects of things that they should be trying to preserve?
Well, before we move off of the water issue here, I think water is probably the primary thing that will be driving any revamping of the landscape.
Right, okay.
So we have to keep that in mind.
Okay, so that's the primary objective we want to end up being more water wise.
More water wise, more water efficient. So after that, the second thing then is appropriate selection of plants.
Okay.
So we want to select plants that are appropriate for our landscape, for our climate, and yet still provide the functions that we want from them.
Right.
So, plants that come from a Mediterranean climate like ours would be good choices. Plants that come from desert regions or regions of the world that have a pronounced and lengthy dry season
would
be good choices for us.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about California native plants, and I think there's some basic misconceptions about the requirements, especially in the first year for establishment for California natives. So let's talk about the water requirements for establishing a native plant and how that differs from something I might get from a big box store.
Well, California natives are good choices generally for our home gardens and landscapes. There are some that wouldn't necessarily be that way, and those would be ones that grow naturally in riparian areas that do require a lot of water.
Right.
For example, like the alder tree, which grows in streams in the San Gabriel and San Bernardino Mountains. It's a nice tree, but if you put it in our landscape, it's going to require a lot of water.
And
it's a California native.
A sycamore, too, is a riparian species, isn't it?
And a sycamore is also. And, of course, a sycamore has another issue, and that's the Polyphagus shot hole borer.
Right.
So we probably don't want to plant sycamores, unfortunately.
It's kind of a target for this pest and the diseases that come from that.
Yes. But selecting plant material that's suitable for our landscape, that can get by on an occasional summer irrigation. And normal winter rainfall, if we ever have normal winter rainfall.
Right.
So that those would be guiding principles there. And then, of course, planting, even drought-tolerant, or what we call traditionally drought-tolerant plants from deserts, plants from Mediterranean climates, California native plants, even those need water to be get established.
Right.
So we'd want to plant those in the fall, and hopefully we'll get winter rain. But if not, then we can irrigate occasionally through the winter and try to develop a good, sturdy root system before next summer. And even if we don't have a lot of rain that winter and we feel we didn't get the good root system established, an occasional summer irrigation is going to be okay for these types of plants.
Okay. So if you're thinking about California natives, you know, Tree of Life down in San Juan Capistrano, they do seminars on this. There's a lot of good information out there. If you're thinking about this, talk to the experts and get a lot more detailed information than we have time to give you right now, because both establishing and maintaining it, these plants are fairly easy to kill. And the other part is most of these plants have not been bred over generations. They're coming to market now, and we don't have the same resistances to diseases and the same plant choices. So, again, it's a new industry. It hasn't been around as long for the home gardeners. California native production has been around for revegetation projects, for big development-type projects, but not so much for the homeowner market. So do get educated if you want to go that way. So let's say a homeowner listening has decided that they do want to get rid of the lawn. We're in the heat of the summer right now, and this might – so let's talk about – if they're going to get rid of a lawn, you know, how do you do that?
Well, the easiest way to do it is to give it a good irrigation so that it's full of water.
Right.
And then spray it with Roundup.
Okay.
However,
glyphosate would be the...
Glyphosate is the active ingredient, yes. However, a lot of people don't want to spray a chemical, and I can understand that.
Right.
So there are a couple other things they could do in place of that. And one of them is solarization, where you cover the lawn with clear plastic.
Right, and stake
it down, and just the days or several weeks of summertime daytime temperatures will get so hot under that clear plastic that it will kill the lawn.
Okay.
Another way is by shading it by putting mulch over it.
Right.
Either either a newspaper or cardboard or something that blocks sunlight, and that will kill the lawn.
So denying also. it light.
Yes.
Okay. And so the reason, so if you're going to take out a lawn, you want to make sure the thing is absolutely dead and gone before you replant, because what happens if you do a half a job on getting rid of your lawn and now you're replanted?
Yeah, if you did a half-baked job.
Right, a half-baked job.
Excuse the pun.
Yes, I like that.
On the solarization. But then you, and if you had something like a Bermuda grass or something that had rhizomes, you could have these rhizomes coming up in the middle of your new plantings, new growth coming up in the middle of your new plantings.
Even if I put in weed cloth and mulch around this new planting, I'm still going to end up with a pretty significant weed problem, aren't I?
Yes. And the other thing that solarization or mulching with cardboard or newspaper or even the use of Roundup or glyphosate does is it will kill weeds too.
Right.
So weeds that could potentially come up in your new landscape.
Now, one of the things I heard in my Master Gardener class was that Roundup, actually, it's a good chemical in that it binds to living organic material, but when it gets on inorganic material, it becomes inert, and really you don't have the same kinds of runoff issues. Or is there a runoff issue with Roundup?
You know what, Chris, I'm unfamiliar with that.
Okay, well, we won't take you there, because again, you see, if you've been listening to the program, you know we're all about the science-based information, and then again, but in general, you're not going to be watering a lawn that you've sprayed with Roundup, so you're not going to have any runoff. If you would do it in a time of year like now, when we're not likely to have any precipitation to create a runoff issue. But my understanding from my class is that in a fairly short amount of time, there really is no active chemical that gets in the water supply. We don't hear about Roundup ending up in the creeks leading into our oceans, killing algae in the ocean. That doesn't happen, because that's not the way that chemical is created.
That's true. But for Roundup to be effective, or glyphosate, the plant cannot be water stressed. That's why I said before you apply it, irrigate the lawn real well.
So if the plant's water stressed, it's not taking up water, it doesn't do its thing.
Yes, the Roundup is less the glyphosate is less effective. So just make sure whatever you're spraying to kill it is well watered before you spray it. And then you don't have to, once you spray it, you don't have to water after that.
So the lawn's gone, I've got the land, it's cleared, and I'm ready, and let's say that I want to replace it with a new and a better lawn. So in the beginning of time, the only way you did lawns was with, you know, you buy a box of seed and you get a bale of peat moss and you do the thing by seed. Does anybody grow lawns from seed anymore, or is that a thing of the past?
Yes, you can still get some of these named turf grass varieties by seed, especially the cool season turf grasses.
Right.
But warm season turf grasses like Bermuda, I think, and Zoysia, I think they're all propagated vegetatively now.
So, no, you can't buy a box of seed for the...
Well, you could get common Bermuda, but you don't want that.
No.
You'd want a name variety of Bermuda. And
okay.
It's propagated vegetatively. So you have to buy the sod.
So in terms of buying sod, going to a local nursery, is that still the best bet, or going directly to the companies that actually grow the sod?
I think getting it from your local nursery is okay.
Okay.
I wouldn't wait till they get it in. I would see if I could special order it so that as soon as it comes in, I can get it.
Or even have them deliver it.
And have them deliver it to my home.
Right.
Because if you just wait till they get it in, you don't know how long that pallet or that stack of sod has been sitting there, and the quality of it will go down if it's been sitting there for several days.
Well, great. And I think we've already talked quite a bit about irrigation, so we probably don't need to do that. So this idea of fertilizing less, again, I didn't read this anywhere, but is that actually part of the information that UC Extension tries to put out there in terms of lawn care?
Well, appropriate culture is good for saving water.
Okay.
And here's what we mean. If you fertilize, you increase growth, which means you're going to have more water. Or if you prune, you often encourage new growth, which means you might need more water.
Right.
So what we're aiming for is a landscape that's more or less static. It grows enough to replace itself,
right,
but not so much that it's going to require these new huge inputs of water and energy.
I hear it. We've come to the close of our show, In the Garden. You've been listening to an interview with Don Hodel from the University of California Cooperative Extension about having a beautiful, healthy, water-wise home landscape. Thanks, Don, for sharing your expertise and time with us.
You're welcome, Chris.
I'd like to end our shows with this reminder. Gardeners live longer, healthier, and happier lives. Thank you for listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Tune in every week, Thursday, 8:30 to 9:30, for another Green Topic.